The Ocean View apartments, for rent by week or month, didn't have an actual view of the ocean. It didn't offer much in the way of amenities, but it had been her home since she had arrived in Los Angeles. It wasn't the first time she had lost a roof over her head, she reminded herself. Maybe permanent homes were for other people. She glanced back at Oliver, who was following her down the hall. "You knew what had happened when my key didn't work," she said. "You realized my landlady had locked me out of my apartment. That's why you insisted on coming back downstairs with me to see about getting a key."
"Someone once gave me the wrong key."
"I see."
"Had a feeling that whoever is trying to make you back off the story might have decided to put the squeeze on you in every way possible."
She stopped in front of the broom closet and opened the door. Three boxes tied up with string sat on the floor next to a bucket, mop, and broom. The name Glasson was scrawled on each box. She reached down to hoist one.
"Aren't you going to open them to make sure all your things are inside?" Oliver said. "Norma Drysdale may have helped herself to a few items."
"It doesn't matter." Irene started back down the hall with the first box. "There was nothing valuable in my apartment. It was just a place to sleep."
Chapter 32. The Ocean View apartments had been more than just a place to sleep, Oliver thought. It had been Irene's home, or at least her refuge from the world. And now it was gone, stolen by a studio fixer who made a nice living paying off corrupt cops and judges and threatening the Norma Drysdales of the world. He arranged the last of the three pitifully small boxes in the back of the car and got behind the wheel. For a moment he sat quietly, watching Irene. She was gazing straight ahead at the front door of the apartment house. Her coolly composed expression gave nothing away, but he could feel the storm brewing just under the surface. It was the second break-in that had unnerved her the most, he realized. She'd had herself under control until Norma Drysdale told her that 2B had been broken into twice. Now Irene looked like she was in a trance.
"It's all right," he said. "You're staying with me until we figure out what is going on, remember?"
At that, she finally looked at him. "Thank you," she said very politely. "But we both know that that won't work indefinitely. I need to make some progress in my investigation before anyone else gets killed."
"I agree." He turned the key in the ignition. "But I think we'll have more luck back in Burning Cove than we will here in L.A.
"Because of the power of Tremaine's studio here in the city." He put the car in gear and drove away from the curb.
"The studios may control Hollywood and, by extension, L.A., but their reach does have limitations. They're not the only game in town in Burning Cove. Neither Luther Pell nor I take orders from the studios."
"Still, the studios have a lot of influence. If they were to forbid their stars from patronizing your hotel or the Paradise Club..."
"You need to keep some perspective, Irene. First of all, we're only dealing with one studio, Tremaine's, and it's not even the biggest or most powerful one in Hollywood. Second, as far as the studio is concerned, this is all about business. Yes, Tremaine is a valuable property, at least for now. They're trying to protect their investment. But if the executives at the top conclude that he's more trouble than he's worth, they'll drop him without a second's hesitation."
"Just business."
"Exactly."
"So I have to find some evidence that will convince the studio that Tremaine isn't worth protecting."
"That's our goal. Ready to go home?"
She shook her head and turned back to contemplate the front door of the Ocean View apartments. "I can't go home," she said. "I just got kicked out of my apartment."
"Slip of the tongue. I mean, are you ready to go back to Burning Cove?"
"I guess so. It's not like I've got anywhere else to go."
"Your enthusiasm is a little underwhelming."
She took a deep, steadying breath and tightened her grip on her handbag. I'm still feeling disoriented. I can't believe that the studio sent someone to break into my place twice.
Neither can I.
She cast him a quick, pleading look. You're supposed to reassure me. Tell me the studio is just trying to frighten me.
I could use some reassurance, too. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I have the distinct impression that you consider the studio threats to be preferable to something else that might be even worse.
She sat very still. He knew she was trying to decide whether or not to confide in him.
You've got a right to your secrets, Irene, he said, but we're dealing with a murder. If there's something else going on, I need to know about it.
She said nothing for a moment, and then she evidently came to a decision. It's a nightmare, she said quietly. I don't even know where to start.
How about starting with whatever you're carrying around in your handbag?
She looked at him, speechless and maybe even appalled. How did you know?
Maybe because you've always got a death grip on it.
She groaned. Is it that obvious?
Probably not to most people.
She gave him a wary look. But you notice details.
Call it a personality quirk. I know you keep your reporter's notebook and that little gun you pulled out last night in your handbag, but there's something else inside, isn't there?
Yes.
Tell me about the nightmare.
Chapter 33. She told him everything. Once she got started, she could not stop. The relief of confiding the terrible secret that she had been keeping for 4 months was so overwhelming that she started to cry. She had not cried in so long, she was surprised to discover that she remembered how. Oliver pulled off on a scenic turnout overlooking the ocean and shut down the powerful engine. She opened her handbag, took out a hanky, and dabbed at her eyes. Sorry, she mumbled. I've been a little tense lately.
No surprise, given what you've just told me.
She pulled herself together and dropped the damp hanky into the handbag. That's it, the whole story. My previous employer was murdered. She left a message in her own blood telling me to run. She wrote a letter letting me know that the notebook was dangerous, that I must not trust anyone, not even the FBI. She said that if the worst happened, I might be able to use it as a bargaining chip. I've been looking over my shoulder ever since that horrible night. Oliver turned in the seat and rested his left arm on the steering wheel. The tinted lenses of his round sunglasses made it impossible to read his eyes. Not that you could read them anyway, she thought. Not if he didn't want you to read them.
You came to California because you're running from a killer, he said. But you have no idea who is after you.
No, she said. None. I've been afraid to trust anyone.
Which brings us back to the problem of the second break-in at your apartment.
It must be a coincidence. What are the odds that whoever is after Atherton's notebook would show up after 4 months and break into my place within 24 hours of when the studio goon broke in?
The odds might be very good if Spencer's killer managed to track you as far as Los Angeles.
But the timing... She broke off, shattered. Damn. The photo of you and me outside the Cove Inn...
Yesterday morning, your picture was on the front page of one of the biggest gossip rags in L.A.
But I changed my name, my job.
She stopped because it sounded weak even to her own ears.
How would he know what I looked like?
All he needed was a reasonably current photograph of you and a good eye for detail.
Miss Spencer loved photography. It was her hobby. She took some pictures of me while I lived with her, including one that showed me standing next to the beautiful car she gave me. I kept it on the dresser in my bedroom. If someone found it, he would not only know what I looked like, but he'd have a description of the Packard.
What happened to the car?
I decided it was too memorable.
I abandoned it on the side of a farm road and hitchhiked for a day. Then I used some of the money that Helen Spencer left in the shoebox to buy an inexpensive used car. When I got to L.A., I sold that one and bought the Ford I'm driving now.
Smart, Oliva said. Switching cars and hitchhiking for a time may have been what saved your life. Tell me more about this notebook that's supposed to be so dangerous.
Evidently, it belonged to someone named Dr. Thomas Atherton, who worked at that laboratory I told you about.
Saltwood. Yes, you said someone there told you that Atherton is dead?
Yes.
Mind if I take a look at the notebook?
She hesitated. Force of habit, she thought. For 4 long months, she had been obsessed with concealing the notebook. It felt strange to bring it out in the light of day and show it to someone else. Oliver waited, not rushing her. She took the stenography notebook out of her bag and flipped it open to reveal the hidden compartment she had created beneath the pad of paper.
Very clever, Oliver said.
She pried Atherton's notebook out of the small compartment and handed it to him. He took off his sunglasses and opened the leather cover. She watched him slowly turn the pages. It's filled with numbers and charts and calculations, but they mean nothing to me, she said. There weren't a lot of science or math classes at the Gilbert School for Secretaries. Oliver turned a few more pages.
They didn't spend much time on either of those subjects at the magician's school, either.
There's a school for magicians?
Sorry, poor joke.
He closed the notebook and handed it back to her.
I have no idea what any of those calculations mean, but I know someone who might be able to help us.
We must not show it to anyone else, I told you. I have no idea who can be trusted.
Relax. We can trust Uncle Chester.
Chapter 34. No doubt about it, Julian Enright thought. He had fallen in love with California, and the Burning Cove Hotel was the very essence of everything he adored about the state. From the palm trees that lined the long, elegant drive to the gracious Spanish colonial walkways and sparkling fountains, the place was a real live version of a movie set. His kind of hotel. He chose a seat at the long, polished bar. The French doors on one side of the lounge stood wide, providing an unobstructed view of the sparkling pool and the swimsuit-clad bodies lounging around it. The bartender was remarkably good-looking. His coppery brown hair was slicked straight back off his high forehead. He had a slender, graceful build and big blue eyes framed with long lashes.
"What can I get you, sir?"
he asked. The voice went with the rest, low and smooth, with just the right touch of smoky sensuality.
"What do you recommend?"
Julian asked, mostly because he wanted to hear more of the lush voice.
"How special is the sunrise? Rum and pineapple juice." "Sounds a little too sweet for me. I'll have a scotch and soda."
"Coming right up." Julian smiled.
"You know, you ought to be in pictures."
"I've heard that."
"Mind if I ask your name?"
"Willie."
"Got a last name?"
"Yes, sir, I do have one of those."
Willie smiled faintly and glided off to prepare the drink. Julian watched him for a moment, trying to figure out just what it was about the bartender that made him so interesting. Generally speaking, he was not attracted to men, but beauty, regardless of gender, always drew his eye. He waited until Willie put the drink on the bar in front of him and moved off to attend to another customer. Then he smiled at the morose-looking man sitting next to him. Another very handsome specimen, Julian thought, but in a more conventional way.
"You're Nick Tremaine, aren't you?" he said.
Nick swallowed some of his gin and tonic and set the glass down hard.
"So they tell me," he said. "According to the papers, you've got a problem."
Nick shot him a wary look.
Who the hell are you?
Relax. I'm here to help.
Did Ogden send you?
Julian looked around, making it appear that he was deeply concerned about the possibility of being overheard. Then he lowered his voice.
No names, he said. If the press gets wind of my purpose for being in Burning Cove, the studio will deny all knowledge of me. Is that clear?
Yeah, sure.
Nick lowered his own voice, but there was a note of hope in his words.
They sent you to clean up the mess.
Someone has to do it. It isn't just your future that is at stake here. The studio has made a considerable investment in you.
Don't you think I know that?
Let's go someplace where we can talk in private.
My private villa, Nick said. Casa de Oro.
Sounds good. But finish your drink first. Make it look casual. You're not in a hurry. You're not worried. You're enjoying your vacation in Burning Cove.
What did you say your name was?
I didn't. It's Julian. Julian Enright.
He didn't hesitate to use his real name. No one here on the West Coast knew him or his family, but even if someone did think to make inquiries, the cover would hold up. It always held up. The Enright name and the long history of the family law firm made an ideal cover. No one ever suspected that Enright and Enright engaged in anything except the most reputable business practices.
Nice to meet you, Julian. You don't sound like you're from this side of the country.
Back east, Julian said.
How long have you been out here?
Julian smiled. Not long enough. He made casual conversation with Tremaine while they finished their drinks. From time to time, he studied Willie the bartender. It took him a while to figure it out, but he was good with details. By the time his glass was empty, he was almost certain he knew what it was about Willie that had aroused his interest. Willie was a woman passing as a very attractive man. Pleased with his deduction, he smiled at her. Willie pretended not to notice.
Got you, babe, he thought.
Having solved the puzzle, Julian lost interest. He had not come to Burning Cove to seduce anyone, male or female. He had a job to do, and he had already wasted enough time. His father had telephoned again that morning, demanding an update and urging immediate action. Evidently, the competition for the auction of Atherton's notebook was heating up. Nick put his glass down.
Let's get moving.
Take it easy, Julian said. Everything is going to be just fine.
It's not your career on the line.
That was true, Julian thought. If he failed to secure the notebook, his father would be annoyed, but there would be other commissions. After all, there was no shortage of people seeking the firm's unique services. But he prided himself on his perfect record. He always got the job done, and he never left loose ends. He and Tremaine ambled through the lobby, making a point of discussing the possibility of a game of golf the next morning. They were strolling along the covered walkway that led to Tremaine's villa when a beautiful car cruised into the long driveway. There was a man at the wheel. He wore sunglasses and an open-collared shirt. A woman, her hair partially covered by a scarf knotted under her chin, sat in the passenger seat. She, too, wore sunglasses, an oversized pair that concealed much of her face. But something about the line of her jaw snagged Julian's attention.
Nice car, he said. Looks custom.
Nick turned his head to look. He grimaced.
They say it's the fastest car in California.
Belong to anyone you know?
That's Oliver Ward's car. Damn, I heard the bitch was sleeping with him. What the hell is she up to?
The bitch?
That's her, the reporter who's trying to destroy me, the one Ogden sent you to take care of.
Irene Glasson?
Yeah.
Well, well, well. Hello, Anna Harris.
we meet at last.
She's sleeping with Ward? Julian asked.
He's a cripple. Bungled his last act. Plenty of good-looking women around the pool, but a guy in his condition probably can't get any of them to fuck him. So, he ends up with the bitch.
Chapter 35.
It feels like she's stalking me, Nick said.
He led the way through the living room of the villa and out onto the shaded patio. They sat down on the big rattan chairs. Julian Enright didn't look anything like Ogden's usual tough guys, he thought. Enright wasn't some beat-up ex-stuntman, and he didn't have the brutish edge of a mob guy. Hell, Enright could have been in pictures himself. He was handsome in a classy, well-bred way. A blonde Cary Grant, maybe. He moved like Grant, too, with a casual elegance that announced to the world that it could wait on him. What's more, the hair looked real, not bleached. His clothes were obviously hand-tailored, and with his tall, lean, athletic build, he looked very good in them. Luckily, Enright wasn't an aspiring actor, Nick thought. He would have been serious competition in the leading man category.
"Tell me everything from start to finish," Julian Enright said. "Don't leave out any details. I need to know exactly what I'm dealing with."
"Didn't Ogden fill you in?"
"I prefer to do my own background research."
"Research?"
"Fact-gathering. Call it whatever you want. Talk to me, Tremaine."
"I told you. It's like she's gunning for me."
"You're sure that you and Miss Glasson have never crossed paths? No one-night stands, a brief affair?"
"I'm positive she's not my type."
Too restless to sit still, Nick got to his feet, clawed his fingers through his hair, and began to pace the patio.
"She's got it in for me, I tell you."
"Any idea why she might harbor a grudge against you?" Julian asked in mild tones.
"Maybe."
Nick paused and then shrugged.
"Something happened to one of the other reporters at that gossip rag she works for."
"What exactly happened to the other reporter?"
"Slipped in the bathtub, hit her head and drowned. It was an accident. The authorities said so."
"But Miss Glasson believes otherwise?"
"I guess so," Nick muttered.
"Then there was another drowning."
"I assume you mean the one that occurred here at the hotel."
"Apparently, Maitland planned to meet Glasson in the spa that night. Pretty sure she was going to feed Glasson some gossip about me. But Glasson told the cops that she'd found Maitland dead in the pool. Next thing I know, there's a hit piece on the front page of Whispers, linking my name with Maitland's. Reporters from papers clear across the country start calling the studio asking for interviews with me."
"Under other circumstances, that would be a good thing."
Cold fingers touched the back of Nick's neck. Enright sounded as if he didn't understand the implications.
"This isn't a joking matter, Enright. Glasson is trying to tie me to the accidental deaths of two women. If this story gets out of control, my career will be ruined."
"Anything else I should know?" Julian asked.
He sounded almost bored now. Nick fought back the red tide of anger. He could not afford to lose his temper. He needed Julian Enright.
"There was another drowning last night," he said. "A local gold digger named Daisy Jennings."
"Did you know Jennings?"
"I fucked her once in the garden of the Paradise Club. That was the same night that Gloria Maitland drowned. Jennings was my alibi."
"And now she's dead."
Nick hesitated.
"It gets worse. Glasson and the magician found the body. Looks like Jennings intended to meet with that damn reporter."
"Did Jennings have something on you?"
"No."
Nick struggled to contain his rage.
"Look, Your job is to keep Glasson from making more trouble, not dig into my sex life. Why don't you go to work?
Thorough research is the key to success in my profession.
Yeah, what exactly is your profession?
Julian smiled. I'm the person people like Ogden call in when they discover they can't deal with a problem themselves. Now then, are you sure you don't have any idea what made Irene Glasson conclude that you were the cause of her colleague's drowning accident?
I'm sure.
There was no way that Irene Glasson could know about Betty Scott, Nick thought. It was impossible. Betty Scott was his past, his buried past.
There must have been some reason why she thinks you are responsible, Julian continued in that same languid tone. All I can tell you is that the other reporter, the one who died, was asking around about me, looking for anything she could find.
But you have no idea what she might have been searching for. Nick grunted.
No, none.
He needed Enright, but damned if he was going to spill his secrets to him.
Interesting, Julian mused. What's that supposed to mean?
Irene Glasson seems to have come across a lot of bodies, Julian said. Nick stared at him.
What are you thinking?
You may be right. Glasson may be setting you up.
You think she killed Gloria and the others?
I have no idea, but it occurs to me that she may be trying to manufacture a story that would make her career. If she can pin a murder rap on you, she would become the top Hollywood gossip columnist in the country, at least for a while.
Yes, that's it, Nick said. Excitement snapped through him. That's it, exactly. She's out to destroy me so that she can grab a headline or two.
Don't worry about it. Julian got to his feet. I'm here to make your problem disappear. Remember?
Yeah, Nick said. I remember.
I'll let myself out, Julian said. He paused briefly.
One more thing. Absolutely no one is to know my real reason for being here. Understand?
What about my personal assistant? Julian shook his head.
No one. As far as everyone around you knows, you and I are just a couple of guys on vacation who struck up a friendship. Got it?
Got it. Julian disappeared into the shadows of the living room. Nick watched more than a little awed. The man moved as silently as a snake. I'm here to make your problem disappear. A moment later, the front door of the villa opened and then closed very quietly. For the first time since the nightmare began, Nick allowed himself a measure of optimism. Maybe, just maybe, he would survive the rolling disaster that had overtaken him. The doorbell chimed. He pulled himself out of his trance.
Come in, he called.
The door opened. Tentative footsteps echoed on the tiles. He stifled a sigh.
I'm out here on the patio.
Claudia appeared in the doorway, clutching her notebook.
Who was that man I saw leaving here? She asked.
Just someone I met in the bar. We're going to play golf together tomorrow.
I see, Claudia said. I came to tell you that Mr. Ogden called again. He told me to tell you that everything is under control.
Nick's spirits soared.
I think Ogden might be right this time.
This time?
Go on, get out of here. I want to work on my lines for Lost Weekend.
Claudia fled.
Chapter 36.
Interesting.
Chester adjusted his spectacles on his nose and studied one of the pages in Atherton's notebook with acute interest.
These look like mathematical formulas, the kind used to calculate distances and angles.
He turned a few more pages.
Ha! Huh.
What is it?
Oliver asked. Chester looked up.
I can't answer all your questions yet. I need time to study these notes.
It would be helpful to know what Atherton was working on at the Saltwood Lab. I can make a telephone call to the company.
No, Irene said, her voice sharpening. I called the lab back at the start. That's how I found out that Dr. Atherton was dead. The person who took the call immediately started to grill me. She tried to find out who I was and why I was calling. It was frightening. My former boss is dead because of that notebook.
Yet she entrusted it to your care, Oliver said. She didn't tell you to destroy it.
No, but she made it clear that I couldn't trust anyone, not even the FBI or the cops. She said she made the mistake of trusting the wrong man.
Chester looked at her.
But she suggested that you might be able to use the notebook as a bargaining chip if the worst happened?
Yes.
Oliver studied her.
Did Spencer spell out what the worst possibility might be?
I think it's obvious, Irene said. She meant that if whoever is after the notebook found me, I might be able to make a deal.
Considering what happened to Helen Spencer, I doubt that any deal for the notebook would end well for you, Oliver said.
Irene winced. I came to the same conclusion, but the notebook is all I've got, so I keep it close. Maybe the second break-in at my apartment has nothing to do with Atherton's notes. Maybe Tremaine's studio really did send someone to break in a second time.
Chester and Oliver looked at her. Neither of them said a word.
She exhaled slowly. I know. What are the odds?
Not good, Oliver said. Unless and until proven otherwise, we have to go with the theory that the second break-in was linked to Atherton's notebook.
Irene locked her arms around herself. Which means that whoever is after it managed to track me all the way to California.
Oliver's brows rose.
It took him 4 months to find you. I'd say you did a damned good job of disappearing.
Not good enough, apparently.
Oliver got a very intent, very thoughtful expression.
Someone lost you and the notebook for 4 long months. Whoever it is will be very relieved to know that he has finally found you. I think he will also be in a great hurry to recover the notebook before you vanish again, or before someone else finds you.
Alarmed, Irene stared at him. Someone else?
If that notebook was worth killing for, I think it's safe to assume that there may be others after it, Oliver said.
Irene groaned. That's not a comforting thought.
If it makes you feel any better, you can bet that whoever killed Spencer is probably concerned about the competition, too, Oliver said.
She eyed him warily. Why should that make me feel better?
It means that whoever found you in L.A. will be strongly motivated to take some risks. And that leads to the very strong possibility that he'll make mistakes, especially if he's pushed to act quickly.
Chester snapped the notebook shut.
We need to know why these notes are so important. I've licensed a few of my patents to various firms around the country. I know some people. Someone out there will have some idea of what is going on at Saltwood.
You must be very careful, Irene said.
Take it easy, Oliver said. Chester knows what he's doing. Meanwhile, I think we should put that notebook in a more secure place. No offense, but your handbag is not exactly Fort Knox.
Instinctively, Irene tightened her grip on the strap of her handbag. I've been afraid to let it out of my sight.
Don't worry, Chester said. After I've finished examining it, I'll put it in a very safe place.
All right, I guess.
You two go on now, Chester said. I need peace and quiet to work on this project.
Oliver grasped Irene's shoulder and gently turned her toward the door.
Reluctantly, she allowed him to steer her out of the workshop. It feels weird, she said.
Giving Atherton's notebook to someone else.
I understand. But we need to know what makes that notebook worth the risk of a murder rap. If we're right about the killer, if he found my apartment in L.A., then by now he knows that I'm here in Burning Cove.
Yes, but he's in my territory now. We've got a good chance of picking him out of the crowd.
How?
He got her outside into the gardens. The sun felt very good, she thought, and the ocean looked especially dazzling.
This is a small town, Oliver said. It will be no trouble at all for Detective Brandon to get us a list of people who have recently checked into the local inns and hotels.
Including this one, she said. I thought you kept your guest list secret.
Oliver looked amused.
We don't give it out to the press, but I make it a policy to always know who is staying in my hotel.
Do you really think the killer would be so bold as to check into your hotel?
I think, Oliver said, that it would be a very smart thing for him to do.
Why?
Because it's the last thing you would expect.
Misdirection.
Either that, or a breathtaking degree of arrogance.
Oliver sounded very thoughtful now.
What makes you so sure you can tell what he's thinking? Irene demanded. You've never met the monster who murdered Helen Spencer.
But I already know a great deal about him, starting with the fact that he is a human monster. There was, after all, no need to murder Spencer in the grisly manner you described.
She shuddered. No.
It sounds like he enjoyed himself. That definitely makes him a monster. In addition, I'm very sure it also makes him arrogant. The receptionist at Whispers mentioned his accent.
What about it?
That fits with the fact that he seemed to have been acquainted with Helen Spencer. Odds are, the man we're looking for is from the East Coast.
Yes, Helen's acquaintance has all moved in very exclusive social circles back east. It's possible she met someone from outside that world, though I just can't say. It's obvious I didn't know nearly as much about her as I thought I did.
We get our share of guests from the East Coast. They tend to stand out.
How? Clothes, manners?
And the accent. Gives them away every time. It would appear that we are dealing with two killers. I think we need some assistance.
The police?
No. Someone who can afford to be somewhat more flexible than the local cops. Luther Pell. Let's go to my office. I'll telephone him and ask him to meet with us as soon as possible.
You're sure you can trust him?
Yes, Oliver said.
A short time later, he put down the telephone and looked at Irene.
Luther will be here in an hour, he said.
She took a deep breath.
All right.
Oliver got the look of a man who had just made a life-altering decision. He grabbed his cane and levered himself to his feet.
Come with me, he said. I want to show you something.
Chapter 37. It was an act of pure impulse, but once the desire to show her the artifacts of his other life had struck, he knew it was what he wanted to do. He did not know why he wanted her to see the relics of the past. He only knew that he needed to show them to her, and that now was the time. He guided her away from the hotel and the surrounding villas. They walked through the gardens and stopped at a wrought iron gate. He unlocked the gate and ushered her through.
Behold the secrets of the illusion of the Burning Cove Hotel, he said, or at least some of the secrets.
Irene studied the cluster of storage sheds, workshops, and the large garage. There were a number of employees scattered about working on vehicle engines, hauling paint buckets, and wielding gardening equipment. When they noticed Oliver, they called out greetings. He responded and then indicated Irene.
"Just wanted to show Miss Glasson how you keep this place operating," he said.
The men chuckled, nodded respectfully at Irene, and went back to work.
"It's like the backlot of a movie studio," she said.
And, like the studios, the hotel makes sure everyone who works here is well-fed. The food is free in the employee cafeteria.
He urged her toward one of the larger buildings.
What I want to show you is, in fact, that big storage locker.
Intrigued, she walked alongside him and paused at the large door while he took out a key. He got the door open, took a couple of steps into the dark, high-ceilinged structure, and found the light switch. When he flipped it, the overhead fixtures came on, revealing the array of tarp-covered objects. The light from the fixtures was not strong enough to penetrate deeply into the gloom inside the prop storage locker. Not even brilliant stage lighting could have dispelled all the shadows, he thought, because so many of them were manifestations of the ghosts of his past. Irene moved slowly into the space and surveyed it with intense interest. Then she turned to look at him. "This isn't old hotel furniture you got stored in here, is it?" she asked. "No," he said. He walked to the nearest tarp and pulled it aside, revealing a large mirror. "After I closed the show for the last time, I was stuck with a lot of stage props and equipment. There wasn't much of a market for the leftovers of a magic act, so I put them into storage." The mirror was a little taller than she was. She moved to stand in front of it and reached out to touch it lightly with her fingertips. "Was this part of the illusion that the girl at the beach mentioned?" she asked.
"It is one of the four mirrors I used," he said. "Want to see how it works?"
She widened her eyes. "I thought magicians weren't supposed to reveal their secrets."
"I perfected this particular illusion. The lady vanishes in the mirror, so I'm entitled to reveal the secret behind it. Besides, the assistants always know the magician's secrets."
"Ah, but I'm not an assistant. We're partners."
"All the more reason why you should know some of the magician's secrets."
She smiled. "In that case, I'd love to know how the lady vanishes in the mirror works." He was pleased that he had managed to distract her, however briefly. In the few days they had known each other, her smiles had rarely lightened the shadows in her eyes. But at that moment, her curiosity had temporarily overridden her fears. He turned away before he was utterly lost in the magic, and pulled off three more tarps, revealing three more tall mirrors.
"In the illusion, the lovely assistant, in this case the magician's lovely partner, stands in front of one of the mirrors," he said. "Right about where you're standing now, in fact."
She met his eyes in the looking glass. "Shouldn't I be wearing a skimpy costume?" she asked. He was almost certain that she was flirting with him. It was both encouraging and unnerving. In the old days, he had been very good when it came to doing a cold read on a person from the audience. But Irene was still very much a mystery in so many ways. He gave her clothes an appraising look. Her menswear trousers defined her small waist and flowed gracefully around her legs. The pale yellow blouse with its feminine bow at the neck and long full sleeves made her look both innocent and seductive.
"The skimpier the better," he said. "After all, the assistant's main job is to distract the audience. But what you have on will do for now."
"What happens next?"
"Good question," he said.
He did not realize he had spoken aloud until he saw that she was watching him with faintly raised eyebrows. Each of the four mirrors was mounted on a set of wheels. He rolled three of them into position around Irene. She was now surrounded on three sides.
"Notice that all of the mirrors have reflective surfaces on both sides," he said. "When properly illuminated on stage, all the mirrored surfaces tend to dazzle the audience."
"More distraction."
"Right. It's one of a magician's most valuable tools. Now, note that three of the mirrors are mounted on narrow frames. When they are turned sideways to the audience, it's obvious that there is no room for even a very slender assistant to be concealed inside."
"Aha! But the other one has a hidden compartment?"
"Yes."
He opened the mirror and showed her the long, narrow box inside.
"It's just wide enough to allow a slim assistant to stand upright. Next, I position the fourth mirror in place. She is now surrounded on all four sides and concealed from the audience."
He pushed the fourth mirror into position. "The assistant opens the mirrored box and gets inside, right?"
Irene said from the interior of the mirrored chamber.
Yes, she does.
He heard a hinged door open and close. In the old days, the hinges would not have squeaked. Chester had kept them well oiled.
Are you inside? He asked.
Yes, this is really a very small space, isn't it?
The boxes are always small, which is, of course, why magicians' assistants are usually small, slender people. If we were doing this on stage, a large curtain would descend at this point, covering the four mirrors. The entire assembly, including the mirrored box with the assistant inside, would be hoisted off the ground to show the audience that there is no secret hiding place beneath the mirrors. The whole thing is then lowered back to the stage. I pull one of the mirrors aside, and the audience sees that there is no assistant inside the chamber.
He rolled one of the mirrors out of the way. Irene had vanished.
Nicely done, he said.
He pushed the mirror back into position.
Now the process is repeated. The curtain is lowered and all four mirrors are hoisted off the floor. The assembly is lowered back down to the floor. The assistant steps out of the concealed box. One of the mirrors is rolled aside and we see that our lovely assistant is back, having just magically emerged from a mirror.
He rolled one of the framed mirrors aside. Irene smiled at him. It's all so simple, she said.
Most of the really dramatic illusions are fairly simple, at least technically speaking. The trick with this one is to make sure the lighting is right, so that the audience never sees the wide sides of the mirrored box that conceals the compartment.
So, the real skill is in the sleight of hand work.
Always, Oliver said. In this case, the magician's job is to shuffle the four mirrors on the stage in such a way that the audience thinks they've seen all of them from every angle. But the truth is, they've only seen three of the mirrors from all sides.
What happens if you have an assistant who gets extremely nervous in small enclosed spaces?
Assistants who suffer from claustrophobia don't last long in the magic business.
I can understand that. Irene shuddered. I think you would have had to fire me by the end of the first performance.
Are you all right? He asked.
Yes, I'm fine. I just wouldn't want to have to climb in and out of those boxes for a living.
As it turns out, I'm not hiring any box jumpers these days.
What happened to the ones who used to work for you? Irene asked. She sounded curious.
Some went their own way after I closed the show, but most of the people who worked for me in the old days decided to go into a new field.
What field?
The hospitality business.
Irene gave him a knowing look. You took care of your crew by giving them jobs here at the hotel.
As I told you, the hotel business and the magic business have a lot in common. The skills required to keep both operating are very similar.
Irene searched his face. Do you miss it a lot?
The magic business, sometimes, but not as much as I did at first. Things change. I've changed. But yes, occasionally I miss that moment when you know you've pulled off the perfect illusion and the audience is thrilled by the effect.
Of course you're bound to miss it sometimes. Magic was your passion, your art. She started to stroll slowly through the jumble of covered props, pausing here and there to peek beneath the canvas. What will you do with these things?
I have absolutely no idea.
He watched her lift the cover off a stack of neatly coiled ropes.
I told you, there's not much of a market for any of this stuff. One of these days I'll have it hauled away.
No, she turned quickly. You shouldn't destroy it. You should save it.
For what?
She spread her hands. For your children or your grandchildren, who knows? One of them might inherit your passion. At the very least, they will be curious about your life as a magician.
I don't have any plans to have children.
You don't? She looked surprised at first, and then she gazed at him with what could only have been described as compassion. I'm so very sorry. I should never have said anything about children. Please forgive me.
For what?
I didn't realize the full extent of your injury.
She glanced down at his leg and then hastily raised her eyes.
I had no idea it was so severe. She broke off, floundering wildly.
It hadn't occurred to me. I never gave it any thought, actually. Not after that kiss at the beach. I just assumed... Please, let's change the subject. Can't you see I'm absolutely mortified?
Understanding finally dawned. He walked toward her and came to halt a few inches away. He set the cane aside and very deliberately framed her face between his hands.
I'd like to make one thing clear, he said. I'm somewhat damaged, but the damage was not that extensive.
Oh, I see.
She swallowed hard and came up with a shaky smile.
I'm so glad.
So am I, and never more so than right now.
He closed the last bit of distance between them, giving her plenty of opportunity to slip away. She did not step back. Instead, she gripped his shoulders with both hands, as though to keep herself upright.
Oliver, she whispered, this probably isn't a good idea.
Why not?
I don't know, she admitted.
And then, in a rush of heat and sensual energy, she released his shoulders, wound her arms around his neck, and kissed him with dizzying urgency. Kissed him as if she wanted him, craved him more than she wanted anything or anyone else in the world. As if she wanted him almost as much as he wanted her. The fire roared through him, hot, fierce, soul-stirring. The ice that had formed a protective shield around him during the past 2 years thawed. The glacier melted and became an avalanche of desire. The eternal gloom in the storage locker was transformed into a hidden world made to welcome lovers. Magic, Oliver thought, the real thing. Somehow he managed to get both of them down onto one of the tarps that he had pulled off the mirrors.
Oliver, Irene said.
His name was a breathless whisper on her lips, filled with wonder and amazement. He did not even try to speak because he knew that if he did, whatever he managed to say would sound incoherent. Instead, he kissed her again, drinking in the hot, sweet taste of her. And then he was fumbling with her clothing. An eon passed before he got the fastening of her silky brassiere undone. Another wave of hunger crashed through him when he finally cupped the sweet, gentle curves of her breasts. He kissed one tight, firm tip. She made a soft, desperate sound, arched against him, and sank her nails into his back. He unfastened her trousers and pushed them down over her hips. She slipped her feet out of her shoes, and then the trousers were gone, and she was left wearing only a pair of panties. She started to undo his shirt, but her fingers trembled. He lost patience and levered himself to a sitting position for long enough to get rid of his shoes and his trousers. He was wearing briefs, the new style of men's underwear. The garment did little to conceal his rigid erection. But it was the wicked scar on his thigh that Irene reached out to touch, not the portion of his anatomy that ached to be clasped in her fingers.
You could have been killed, she said.
She sounded stunned.
I mean... I knew your wound must have been bad, but I didn't realize.
The shocked sympathy in her words was maddening. He captured her hand and very deliberately moved it from the scar to the front of his briefs, making her aware of his need.
I could have been killed, but as it happens, I wasn't, he said. Now, if you don't mind... I'd rather move on to a more interesting subject.
She blinked, and then, tentatively, her palm closed over him. She explored him gingerly, cautiously, as though she was unsure of herself. He groaned. Hastily, she withdrew her hand.
Aren't I doing it right? She said anxiously.
Irene, he got out between clenched teeth. You have done this before, haven't you?
Yes, a few times, but I don't think I was very good at it.
I'm going to faint.
What?
Horrified, she sat up very fast.
Lie down.
I am lying down.
Shall I get a cold compress?
I don't think that will do any good.
Do you need a doctor?
She started to reach for her blouse. I don't need a doctor. He imprisoned her hand again and pulled her gently down on top of his chest. I need you. Tell me, what went wrong when you tried this before?
He was a lying, cheating bastard.
That explains it.
It turns out that I wasn't the first secretary in the history of modern business to make a fool of herself with her boss.
I get the picture.
He cradled her face between his palms.
I want to make this special for you.
Trust me, this is special, she said. She kissed him, and he was lost. Desire heated his senses until all he could think about was sinking himself into her soft, supple body. The surroundings were hardly romantic, but he had one thing going for him. He was very good with his hands. When she came for him, breathless, shuddering in his arms, then and only then did he allow himself to thrust into her. She gasped, wound herself around him, and held on with all her strength. His release pounded through him, and the world outside the storage locker disappeared, taking the past with it, at least for a time. Magic. Chapter 38. Luther Pell propped one forearm on the bar and considered the earth-shaking news that Willie had just delivered in a very low voice and with all the drama suited to the announcement.
"He took Miss Glasson into the props storage locker?" Luther said. "Are you absolutely certain?"
"That's straight from Hank's lips." Willie polished a wine glass with a white towel. Hank got it from one of the gardeners, who saw the boss unlock the door himself. Luther whistled softly.
"Big news, all right."
Willie raised her brows.
"What's more, they're still inside, according to Hank. He says they've been in there nearly an hour."
"Evidently, Miss Glasson is very interested in a certain magician's props."
"If you ask me, the most fascinating aspect of the situation is that a certain magician seemed keen to take Miss Glasson on a tour of his props."
"You're right," Luther said. "As a matter of fact, I can't recall the magician in question ever having escorted any lady into the prop locker for a private tour."
"Neither can I."
Willie slotted the wine glass into the overhead rack. "You heard what happened at the warehouse fire last night?"
"The story is all over town."
Willie smiled.
"The boss ordered ice from room service. Rick in room service made the delivery. The boss explained what had happened at the warehouse. Rick told the kitchen staff, who passed the story on to housekeeping and security. And the next thing you know, it's all over town."
"Small town," Luther reminded her.
He swallowed some of the sparkling water that Willie had poured for him and thought about the meaning of it all. One thing was clear. Irene Glasson was different, and not just because she had refused to abandon Oliver in a burning building. It wasn't that Oliver didn't like women. Oliver had escorted other ladies to the Paradise Club, and he had indulged in a couple short, discreet affairs since arriving in Burning Cove. But Irene Glasson was different, Luther reflected. He and Oliver had known each other ever since Oliver purchased the hotel. In spite of the age difference between them, they had become friends from the start. Luther figured it was because each of them had recognized a kindred soul in the other, or maybe just another lost soul traveling the same path. Whatever the case, it was the kind of soul you wanted at your back in a bar fight, a soul you could trust with your secrets. Both of them had been damaged when they arrived in Burning Cove. Each of them had made a fresh start in a town that encouraged reinvention. Each had done a good job of concealing the damage, but neither of them tried to pretend to the other that the damage didn't exist. Maybe that was the real reason for their friendship.
"Looks like the private tour is over," Willie said, glancing past Luther's shoulder. "Here comes the boss. He's alone. Wonder what happened to Miss Glasson."
"Let's assume he didn't leave her in the prop locker."
"Probably a safe assumption."
Luther swiveled the bar stool around a quarter turn and saw Oliver coming toward them through the lightly crowded bar.
"It strikes me that Ward's bad leg doesn't seem to be bothering him as much as usual," he said.
"I do believe you're right," Willie said.
Oliver was dressed, but his shirt was open at the collar and his hair looked like it had been combed with his fingers. Aside from that, he appeared in rare good spirits.
"Afternoon, boss," Willie said. "Can I get you anything?"
"No, thanks," Oliver said. He looked at Luther.
"Front desk told me you were here. Let's get back to the villa. We can talk there."
Oliver started to turn away. Luther stood.
"Where's Miss Glasson?"
"She's at the villa," Oliver replied. "Said she wanted to freshen up."
Luther glanced at Willie. Willie suddenly became very busy polishing the already glowing top of the bar.
"Heard you took Miss Glasson on a tour of those old props you got stored out back," Luther said.
Oliver's eyes narrowed ever so slightly.
"Word travels fast around this hotel."
"I can understand why Miss Glasson would want to freshen up," Luther said.
"Is that so?" Oliver said evenly.
"Those old props have been stored in that locker for quite a while now. Probably dusty from lack of use."
Chapter 39. Irene heard Oliver and Luther arrive just as she finished running a brush through her hair. She put on some lipstick and checked her image in the mirror. She was feeling oddly cheerful, and she thought she looked unusually bright and vivacious for a woman who had just engaged in hot, sweaty sex in a storage locker. In hindsight, maybe she shouldn't have been so cautious after the disaster with Bradley Thorpe, she thought. Life was short. Sex, at least the kind she had just enjoyed, was exhilarating. A woman had a right to grab the good things when they came around. Perhaps she should have taken advantage of the opportunities that had come her way during her year in Helen Spencer's fairy tale world. But even as the thought occurred, she was quite certain that she would have wound up regretting a liaison with any of the charming, polished gentlemen she had met during the course of that year. For one thing, most of them had been jaded, bored, and utterly lacking in principles. They drank too much. They partied too hard. They were often thoughtless or downright cruel to those they considered beneath them. They lived for superficial entertainments, and they would have considered the seduction of Helen Spencer's private secretary a form of entertainment. But everything was different with Oliver. She gripped the edges of the pedestal sink with both hands and studied her reflection in the mirror, searching for an explanation. Perhaps the episode in the storage locker had been so intense and so freighted with meaning because she and Oliver had endured a danger together. The experience had probably created some sort of bond between them. If that was the case, she had to accept the fact that the bond was, in all likelihood, temporary. But it was real, which was a hell of a lot more than she could say about the connection she had felt with Bradley Thorpe. Then again, Bradley had been a lying, cheating bastard. She turned away from the mirror, let herself out into the hall, and went down the stairs. Oliver and Luther were on the patio, sitting in the shade. Both men got to their feet when they saw her. Luther smiled at her. The smile looked genuine, but there was something odd about the way he was looking at her, she thought. It was almost as if he approved of what he saw. But that made no sense. He barely knew her.
"Miss Glasson," he said, "a pleasure to see you again."
She smiled and sat down. "I thought we agreed that you would call me Irene."
"We did, indeed."
Luther took his seat. His dark gaze sharpened.
"Tell me what's going on."
Things have gotten complicated, Oliver said. We need some assistance.
How complicated? Lutha asked.
We think that a killer may have followed Irene here to Burning Cove.
Lutha's brows rose. The one who murdered Gloria Maitland and Daisy Jennings?
Another one, Oliver said. And if we're right, he is far more dangerous.
What makes him more dangerous?
If I'm reading the guy right, he's a pro who enjoys his work.
Chapter 40. That night, they dined in the hotel's restaurant. The room was crowded when they walked in shortly after 8, but they were immediately seated in an intimate booth on the balcony level. The position provided a measure of privacy while simultaneously allowing a sweeping view of the main floor. It was, Irene reflected, a lot like sitting in a box seat at the theatre. From her position, the dining room was a stage set, lit by candlelight. The scene sparkled with crystal, polished silver, and glamorously dressed people. Oliver's martini and Irene's pink lady materialized along with an appetizer tray that featured lobster canapes, olives, and caviar.
"I take it this is your personal booth?" Irene asked.
"I like to keep an eye on my guests, and the view is excellent from up here," Oliver said. "Most of the people who stay in my hotel eat dinner here, even if they're planning to go out to one of the local clubs later in the evening. I can get a list of those who don't have reservations here tonight and those who order room service, if necessary. But I'm betting that our visiting monster doesn't think that he has any reason to hide."
"What makes you so sure he'll be here at your hotel?"
"You're the one he's after, and you're here."
"No offense, but your reasoning is quite chilling. Do you really think you can identify him?"
"If he's here, yes. I'm good at reading people in an audience, Irene. It's not that hard once you learn to pick up the cues."
"How do you do it?"
"Like most illusions, it's really very simple," Oliver said. "You let the subject tell you everything."
"That actually works."
"How do you think fortune tellers, psychics, and mediums make their livings?"
"I've always assumed that people who claim to be psychic were all frauds."
"They are, but they wouldn't stay in business if they didn't put on very convincing acts."
"You're a magician," she said, "not a fortune teller or a psychic or a medium. You didn't defraud people by making them believe that you could tell them their future or put them in touch with the dead." He looked surprised by her vehemence.
"Thank you," he said. "I like to think there was a difference between my cold read performances and the fraudulent variety. But the only real difference is that my audience understood that it was an act, just a clever trick. And for the record, I never performed the Talk to the Dead scam."
"Of course not. People might have taken that seriously. So many do believe in spirits. You wouldn't want to be responsible for making someone think that he or she really had communicated with the dead. That would be cruel." He seemed a little amused by the certainty in her voice.
"I was a magician, not a con artist," he said. "But as I told you, a lot of the techniques used in both careers are the same."
"So, what do you see when you look out at your audience tonight?"
He surveyed the dining room. "A lot of people with too much money and too much time on their hands. A lot of people trying desperately to have fun. A lot of people pretending to be someone else, at least for a night. But here and there, I see people who wish they were somewhere else."
"Or with someone else?"
"Oh, yeah," Oliver said. "A lot of those people. I also see some who are trying to reinvent themselves."
"Such as?"
Oliver swallowed some of his martini and angled his head very casually toward a booth down below.
"See the two women sitting together in the corner?"
Irene followed his glance and spotted an attractive blonde dressed in a yellow gown with a cowl neck cut very deep. The woman with her was a brunette dressed in violet.